Session number 28625, Reel 24.
They would enjoy it. I'd always give them the challenge of if they worked hard and performed adequately, that we would have a release from the plague. But if they weren't behaving, then I had to threaten them that we'd stay long enough to do so. So there was an incentive there. You have to crack a foot down again.
One of the things I thought earlier, and I meant to ask you about it, was when you said that you know, the band had played the Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
And I thought of a period of time that you were speaking about, which was quite a time of change. You know, men had started to grow their hair longer, maybe the hippies were starting to come in and that.
Mm.
And I was just wondering how the men within the army were maybe coping with the discipline in that. Obviously, mm-hmm. the ones in the army wanted to be in the army.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think there was ever any time when, you know, maybe you just got this feeling that things were changing, that society was changing?
Well, I remember in 1956, in Cyprus, and rock and roll started, and we were an active service. But we would get films at the base headquarters. And I remember Bill Haley and his rock and roll people had come along and produced a film. And I remember we were advised as senior NCOs to go to the film and be able to cope with the inevitable. But we didn't have the inevitable. I mean, there was noise, a clapping of feet and things like that. And the soldiers accepted it. And of course, these things are noisy and whatever, but we had no disturbance as was envisaged by the powers that be, the psychological buffoons. I've never seen it affect. Perhaps growing hair longer and sideboards, which seem to be acceptable these days, we restrained that. We made it fairly obvious that, you know, long-haired soldiers never looked well under a bomber cap, a tam o' shanter.
And did they accept that okay? Or
yes. Mm. Yeah. I mean, obviously when they went out, they found a release and a freedom. But it was fairly obvious that we had to temper this with an acceptable standard.
Okay. And when they were in Germany as well, did they get out and about?
Yes,
you know?
They had freedom. Many of the married quarters were all out with in different areas. Soldiers could go out as much as they wished. It wasn't too easy for them, I don't think. The single lad, I don't suppose it is altered very much to this day, unless you have a command of the language. And by so doing, I mean, you'll achieve more. And when people see that instead of you expecting everybody to speak English, that you can speak their language, then you know, you've made an effort to understand their culture and their language.
Okay then.
Good morning, Mr. Strachan.
Morning, Marilyn.
The last time we stopped at Palace Barracks, where you went to in 1976.
Uh-huh.
So it was just to continue with some sections that we hadn't spoken about there. And also maybe about, I believe there was an exercise before you went to Northern Ireland, was there, which involved the northeast of Scotland?
Yes, we did. We were at Fort George and we got permission when General Graham was commanding to train in Fraserburgh. And using the old railway station, derelict sort of area, as a base, which was ideal for what we were doing. And we had an intensive training exercise in that area, very successful too.
And can you remember your role in it?
Well, I was doing a dual role. I was assisting as a sort of... a supervisory sort of role, and I'd be able to go along and using my experience to judge certain situations and you know, make corrections, make observations which would come up at the end and then at the workshop.
Oh, so you weren't actually in amongst the exercise itself, were you?
As an individual, as a sort of referee type thing, there was a nucleus of half a dozen of us who were pulled from the different logistic jobs that we normally did, and our experience was being pooled, and we were umpires, and really that was the definition of what we were doing.
And did you think this exercise helped the men for when they went to Northern Ireland?
Yes, lots of the situations and the scenarios were lifelike and perhaps taken from previous incidents and analysed and utilised, and yeah, it was a great benefit.
And were the local people of Fraserburgh involved in it as well?
In some cases, yes. The householders were very good in that they allowed us to and doing a search or a follow-up of somebody, and we had one lady, Mrs. West, who was the mother of our chief clerk, Alistair, who sadly just died, and she was very cooperative and allowed us to go in her front door and out the back door type thing, and that was one of the set pieces we had. Yes, they're friendly people. They fully realised what we were doing, and I think we reacted in accordance.
And do you think this exercise, do you think it affected their lives? You know, I know that you spoke about Mrs. West, but do you think it maybe upset, I don't mean upset their lives, you know, but did it affect their life for maybe how long the exercise went on? Would it have caused?
I think the majority of people were sympathetic to the cause and realised fully what we were trying to achieve. It isn't often that you have an area in the northeast of Scotland where you can do realistic things and charging with vehicles or on foot throughout the streets, etc. But yes, the police and the public, I recall, were very cooperative, very understanding. No doubt we upset one or two, but then again, you get that anywhere you go.
And did the exercise last for a long time, or was it just an idea or something?
We did it over a period of, I seem to recall, 5 days, perhaps. 5 days.
And do you think people knew it was actually in preparation for Northern Ireland?
Oh, yes, we're fully aware. We kept everybody informed what our intention was and how grateful we were.
Okay. So then you went to Palace Barracks in Belfast, which we've already said.
Yes.
And what was your job there? Were you still a quartermaster?
Yes, I was a technical quartermaster, looking after all the equipment and ammunition and things like that, weapons.
And the weaponry for Northern Ireland, had it changed any from what you had used previously in like Singapore or the jungle? Or?
It has now, it hadn't at that time.
So it was still the same type of
same weaponry, same style. It was much later that they changed the rifle.
Okay, and I know that you've spoken about Palace Barracks having everything, having a swimming pool and gymnasium and really having everything within it. I was wondering how, you know, like your social life, or for entertainment, did you still remain within the Palace Barracks, or did you go out?
We kept within the perimeter for all social functions. We had pubs, had guides and all of that, the wives clubs, kindergarten, and each area would produce a whist drive or a bingo night, or there was a nasty there too. It was a sort of nomadic area that we were in, within a perimeter in which we were all contained.
And was there much mixing with people who weren't in the Gordon Highlanders? You know, did you mix with the local people at all or anything?
There were occasions when, for example, I used to be looking after the tug of war boys, and we would compete locally in the country areas, but that was an area that had to be well sussed out, and we had to be quiet and dignified and get in there and civilians and by vehicle. But if we formed a good relation with the local people in Tullamore, and they were very hospitable, you were always assured a good Irish meal when you went there, and sometimes a glass of ale. But yes, they were predominantly extremely hospitable, fine people.
And what about in Belfast? Was there areas at that time that you maybe had to be careful with or anything?
Yes, yes, there's no social tie attached to the city at all. You weren't in any way permitted to meander through or be involved in, and you just weren't allowed to be social or go to pubs or anything of that nature.
So was that an actual rule, or was it just like...
You just didn't go. It was written or unwritten. You'd be extremely foolish to attempt it.
Okay. And in your job as a quartermaster, technical quartermaster, did that really mean that you were more on the administration side of the army life?
Yes, logistics side. I'd be responsible for all the weapons, all the equipment, and making sure that it was maintained, resupplied, and whatever special items they required, encompass my department.
And with like a situation like Northern Ireland, did that mean as well that like your job, this supply of weaponry and ammunition, that did it become busier because the troops were maybe more involved in things?
Yes, it did. Each regiment had a particular number attached to it, and it was called a unit identification number. And if the prefix letter was A, it meant it was the main unit, and B on it meant it was the rear party unit. I think when you required something, you would fill in forms, and you put this identification number on it, and the system realized exactly where you were, and this was applicable to the finance side as well. As a regiment, you had this code. And you also had a different degree of urgency that you would place on the computer form. And that it was just a normal thing, you would perhaps get it within a fortnight to 3 weeks. But if it was a great urgency and necessity, then you would mark it to a greater level, put it off, and the system would respond. Fairly obviously, you have to be full of common sense and not abuse it. And it worked.
And was this really before the days of computers, or were computers starting to come in at this point?
We always had that number. The whole of the services, so that everybody knew exactly who you were, where you were, etc.
Okay. But was most of this paperwork, was that most of that done by like hand or...
By hand, mm-hmm. Yes, in my time, yes. Now it's computer.
Okay, and for the type of situation you were in then in Northern Ireland as well, did that change your hours of work or anything? Did your...
Yes, we were on a 7-day cycle. Obviously there were periods where people could go and rest, but that didn't mean socialise. But it was a 7-day cycle, and you had to be prepared to move to supply the urgency of need of whoever was in a particular problem or in requirement of equipment.
Okay. And was the Gordons involved with other people, with their role in Northern Ireland? Was there much involvement with the local police?
With the local police, very much so.
And were you involved in any of that?
Not really. I was a backroom individual. They could produce it what was required.
Okay. And did you have any, was there like any budgetary demands that you had to look to as well? If somebody said, well, I want X, Y, and Z, were you just allowed to order it, or did they ever say, well, to watch my budget or something?
Yes, we had budget for certain things. For example, food, but ammunition, no. You were obviously aware of certain commodities, but it didn't prevent you from asking for what you required, and then the system would appreciate the situation and give it to you. but it was all controlled and audited.
Okay, and with Palace Barracks as well, was it a fenced-in barracks or did it have a wall or anything around it?
Fence, a security fence.
And was that guarded?
Yes, indeed. It was at the main entrance with the guard room, and there was patrolling elements, both in foot and vehicles, and we had dogs. It was a 24-hour dedicated security. You did have, for example, single gates which were locked so that the people who lived just outside, for instance, a group of 12 officers lived outside, one of which was myself, and we all had keys that allowed us to get in and out.
And was it considered safe enough to live outside?
Yes.
And had you to take any special security? You know, had you to do anything special, like check your house or your vehicle or anything?
You'd obviously check your car each time you required it. We all had garages those outside, but yeah, you had to remain vigilant.
Okay, and how did your wife cope with maybe this increased security? You know,
she was an experienced wife, like most married girls, and responded to the situation in a healthy way. When she ran the kindergarten, which was certainly 90 to 100 strong there, and the dad was very much involved in that for 5 days a week. But conversely, she went shopping on her own, or with a friend, a chum, into Belfast, or to Holyrood, or to Bangor, and places like that, which you could do. Being aware that you'd be searched before you went into the shop, etc., etc. But they all understood that, and blessed them, reacted healthily.
And were the wives and families helped in any way? You know, I know that you've spoken before about, you know, the men getting lectures and you know, being told about what's going to happen or mm-hmm. what may happen in mm-hmm. Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Did the wives get something so that?
Yes, periodically there would be a get together in which all families were invited to attend. And we did have a family officer in situ, and he was able to conduct such things. That. Yeah.
And what about when you had leave? You know, because I believe you were in Northern Ireland, was it for 18 months?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And during that period, I would have expected you to have some leave.
Yes.
Did you come back to Scotland, or did you stay in Northern Ireland?
I went to Germany where my oldest daughter was, and she was giving birth to her first child. So, it didn't come as it maybe should have done, so I had to return myself and leave my wife there until it was born. And that was the only period that we had.
I was just thinking, like, how, you know, when you'd been speaking about other locations, like in Singapore and Germany and that, you'd always spoken about, you know, going and visiting the other areas near where you were. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could do that in Northern Ireland.
No. Nor could you go into the south of Ireland. It wasn't any movement was discouraged. But you certainly had access to going to the mainland. No problems in that.
Okay. And I think you mentioned off here that like your youngest child was still at one of the local schools.
My son.
Oh, your son. Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes, he was doing the 11th in Bangor. And he was able to play golf a bit too. And that was obviously interesting for him. And my youngest daughter, she worked in one of the military camps, at Moscow camp in Belfast. She was a secretarial in the deal there.
And was that far from where Palace Barracks was?
Not really.
And what like was the area surrounding Palace Barracks? Was it an old area or quite a new area?
An old area. It was an old stone camp. Huge area, actually, contained everything that I mentioned previously. And you looked on to the Belfast Lough. I mean, I recall sitting in my sitting room looking out and seeing the ferry come in and out every day and night. They were very pleasant. You could walk into Holyrood Village, which was just a village amenity, one main street as it were, or you could go in civilians, of course, to Bangor or Belfast if you wished. But again, you have to be cautious.
In the area where the barracks were as well, had that ever suffered from any of the troubles? You know.
Well, yes, indeed. I recall being on the sports field and preparing for our annual tug of war competition when this car had come into camp, and in it was being driven by a former painter, a big man who'd been in the camp with his team and painting where my wife was teaching the children. And this day he came into camp very agitated, and the lads in the gate stopped him, told him to get out, and he wanted to run away, and they held on to him, and thanks to a lad from Bucky, whose name escapes me, but he was wise enough to say to this chap, look, come on, or something like that, move this car. And the chap wouldn't do it, and eventually the sentry said, I'll move it or I'll shoot you. And the man then realised that he meant business, so he moved the car, and he said, there's a bomb in it. And he said, I was apprehended at home, put it in a car, his car was loaded with ammunition, explosives, and he was ordered to get into the car, leave the car there, put it beside the headquarters building, so it would be blown up, and if he didn't do this, then his family was in the other car, and they'd be shot. So that was not an unusual scenario. Well, everybody dispersed, and the car blew up, and that created havoc, as it were, but nobody was injured, fortunately. But that's an example of what could happen, what did happen.
Did you hear the noise of this explosion?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, one saw it.
So when that happened, you know, what did you feel like? You know, can you remember your thoughts?
I didn't look at it too seriously when it first went up, and I thought, well, gosh, that's certainly a cracking thing. But I then realised it was quite near to where I had the ammunition, and which was obviously safe enough. And by the time we all sort of stood to and realised and got the facts of the thing, thanks to this laddie from Bucky being very alert, and he was awarded some citation after for it. But it's an example of how you can't trust everybody or anybody, and people. You know, their intelligence is such that they were aware that this foreman would be in the camp for some considerable time and was hailed and acknowledged by people thinking, oh, he's all right, he's safe. But of course, you can never judge situations.
So did you think that you personally, you know, that maybe you had to start looking at situations slightly different then, you know?
There were people who were in charge of security. It was all put in a melting pot and analysed and assessed, and obviously from situations like that you made some adjustment.
It sounds as though it kind of took it home then, doesn't it?
Oh yes, yes, it makes you fully aware of how vulnerable you all are.
Okay. And when the Gordons were involved in any of the incidents or marches or anything like that, that was involved at that time, did that make any difference to your work as well? So
only to be aware that there was maybe a requirement for certain things, and you had to be to stand by in a way to communication.
Okay. And then, so when it came for time to leave Northern Ireland, was it the whole battalion who were leaving, or was it just part of?
No, the whole battalion left, and we went to Chester. I'm trying to remember the name of the camp. Midfield,
okay. Was that in
Satan Camp in Chester? That's it. Satan Camp in Chester.
And just the way it sounds, is that how it's spelled?
S-A-I-G-H-D-O-N.
Okay.
Satan Camp.
Okay.
And that was an old established camp, but a huge hutted camp, which on the River Dee, and within a mile and a bit of Chester.
And was that in 1978?
Yes.
And why did they send you to Chester? Why do you think they didn't send you somewhere in Scotland?
Well, the system allows for you to be posted to where they believe you should be, or the situation warrants, and you take on a different role from the 18 months that you've been doing constant. You had a change of role, and they stopped doing that now, but in those days you could end up in, you know, being in Dover, or Inverness, and Chester.
And so was it an old camp there you mentioned?
Yes, it was an old camp which, wartime, which would have been able to house three units, and obviously some of it was dilapidated and in the process of being pulled down. But it was hutted and self-contained, and the usual provisions in it.
And how did it compare to Palace Barracks? Which one would you have said was the nicer camp?
Well, you had greater freedom and fresher air that you could breathe in Satan Camp. You were relieved, because undoubtedly anything you do in Ireland for as long a period as that allows you to suffer from stress, strain, or fatigue, or whatever. And it was just a light relief to go to such a beautiful place as Chester.
And was your personal accommodation, was it in the camp now, or were you outside?
No, I lived outside, walking distance from the camp, out the back gate, where we had a cul-de-sac of seven houses.
Okay. And was your wife and, well, some of your family still with you there?
Yes, still had one with me. One had been off to work in England, and the other one was married and living in Germany.
Okay. And was the camp itself, did it have like a wall round it or anything, or a fence?
And guarded.
Okay. And I believe you got promotion round about this time as well, did you?
I was a major, promoted major.
And to become a major, do you have to sit any exams or anything? Or
no.
No.
No, it all comes through your report and the progress you've been making, and over a specified period of time.
And is there any other benefits you get, like a better house or anything?
Yes. I would get, well, not necessarily a better house, but you'd be entitled to, say, three bedrooms. Perhaps four, I think I had four, actually. And it's a bigger house.
Okay.
And you also got the travel first class and the railway, which I think I only used once. Great perk.
And what about your role as well within the army? Were you still doing a similar role to what you had been doing before? Or
well,
did
I was doing a general quartermaster now at that particular time, which included all the accommodation stores, all the buildings, all the food, the general maintenances and civilian labour, the general quartermaster, maintenance quartermaster, whatever.
And did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. Something different, something new, something that you could get into, as it were.
Okay, and what was the battalion's role in Chester? What were you actually doing there? You know.